Informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to this, the last Big Picture of the 2013-14 academic year. I'm your host, David Hayes, and tonight I'm putting questions about some of the biggest issues in the news today to a panel of Nottingham students. Joining me for this swan song of a show, we have got...
Seb Bench, second-year politics student.
And...
Luke Moyu, third-year mechanical engineer.
There you go. I probably shouldn't have tried to say swan song of a song, should I? Welcome all, anyway. Tonight we'll be discussing the ISIS insurgency into Iraq and what it could mean for peace in the Middle East, the run-up to the September 19th referendum on Scottish independence, and the controversy surrounding the Sun's free-issue marketing stunt. If you have an opinion on any of that, you can, of course, text in and join the discussion live on URN by the usual ways. If you have a conventional phone, text 07762212434, or you can send us a free web text at urn1350.net. We've actually got a spare mic in the studio tonight, so if anyone in the studio fancies getting in on the debate, they can as well. I highly doubt it. In any event, let's get straight on to the first debate. The past few weeks have seen a massive spike in violence in Iraq as the insurgent organization known as the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIS, spreads its influence across the Syrian border, seizing the important cities of Mosul and Tikrit and laying siege to some of Iraq's most profitable oil refineries. As fears of fresh challenge to the young regime installed after the US-UK invasion in 2003 that ousted Saddam Hussein, come thick and fast, allegations of blame have followed on their heels. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair has explicitly said that ISIS's gains had nothing to do with the 2003 invasion that he controversially co-led, instead blaming upon the West's inaction over the over the Syrian civil war. However, this has been met with popular outcry, as well as certain politicians, most notably London Mayor Boris Johnson, coming in and telling him that he's basically talking a load of nonsense. In the States, Obama finds his regime's inaction under fire from the other side of the House, and there seems to be a growing mood for intervention, particularly as Iraq formally requests US airstrikes against the insurgents. My first question, then, is whose fault are the insurgencies? Is it the fault of the 2003 invasion or something else? Seb, why don't you kick us off?
I think there's no doubt that this current situation has to be partly blamed on the 2003 invasion. Naturally, any invasion does create instability, and instability that isn't necessarily resolved quickly. And, well, we're told many things before the Iraq War, but one of the things was there would be kind of quick, relatively cheap, simple, and the Iraqi people would love us for it. None of those turned out to be true, and those took years and years longer than expected. And even after, as similar to his case in Afghanistan, as George Bush proclaimed victory on a US warship and said it was over, in reality took the eyes off the ball, and a couple of years later, the insurgency happened, which did extend the war itself for a couple of years, and have shown now and recently that it's not over. And clearly for a couple of years there have been still some problems with insurgencies and particularly sectarian violence, and I believe it was earlier this year when Fallujah was taken by ISIS. So clearly it's a problem that's carried on going. I think certainly to an extent it's got to be considered certainly the Iraq War has to be considered a contributing factor, although at the same time I would also say the sectarianism that is a large part of various parts of Middle Eastern politics at this stage is also a perhaps the major factor, but the Iraq War really made the created the conditions which really allowed this to flourish. Sounds slightly wrong for such a negative course of events, but it certainly helped it happen.
Luke, what's your opinion?
I place the responsibility on both the American government at the time during the Bush era and Tony Blair for readily going along with the plan, because at first they wanted to go into Iraq because they had so-called weapons of mass destruction, which was showed in later years they didn't have any evidence, and the evidence they had was falsified. So I believe a series of events of destroying the infrastructure of Iraq, causing a lot of disposition of quite a large population of people and discontent, has caused a lot of sectarian groups to form and trying to retake Iraq and form it as their own and not a representation of the West.
Yeah, I think it's also important to add that the Iraq War could have had less of an impact on this had the reconstruction phase been carried out far better. but as kind of saying in international relations, whoever broke it owns it. And while it's very easy to start wars, just as is the case in Iraq, it's much harder to actually, it's easy to win the war but lose the peace, as they say. It's much harder to reconstruct a country after you've kind of taken its infrastructure and taken its lead, and in this case of Iraq, claimed victory in some sense. Eventually, a couple of years here later, they did actually start to focus on that, and it seemed like Iraq was in definitely relatively, and I think relatively is the key place compared to how it was earlier, but I feel had there been, from really day one of supposed victory, a much better management of the situation, this could have been, if not avoided, certainly mitigated.
A range of factors then. One particular aspect of the growing situation in Iraq is the role of Iran. Now, Iran, historically an enemy of the Iraqi state, has stepped in and is trying to give them some assistance against ISIS. And we've seen sort of a concomitant cooling of their relationship with the West. They've accepted a British embassy for the first time since the 2011 attacks that saw the ambassador flee the country. I guess my question is, what are we to make of Iran's engagement in this? Is it positive, or is there something more sinister behind all of this? Seb?
I'd say it is positive. Firstly, because although, as I said there, Dave, they have been historically enemies, and so that probably does drive this, as does geopolitical politics, as it does in many international relations. They, you know, Iran both don't want Iraq to be too strong, but also I don't think want a terrorist group operating on their border, or at least not a terrorist group which they directly control or influence. And to add to that, clearly this has helped a cooling between Iran and the West, but it should be noted that relationships have slowly been getting better, and there's at least been progress on things like nuclear deals, and as Syria has become less of a frontline issue, the West person fade into the back there, then the tension from that has faded. So, yes, I think it is partly Iran disliking Iraq, going with their self-interest. But at the same time, due to the gradual and moderate improvement in relations between West and the Iran, it is easier to trust them and easier to work together. And I think in the case of this, what seems to be in both of a self-interest to do something relatively similar, I think we can at least trust each other. If we don't trust them in all circumstances, at least trust them to do what's in their own best interest.
I do believe it's a positive thing. I won't add much to my comrades' information, but to have Iran, who was formerly an enemy of Iraq and fought for many years, to actually help Iraq with with ISIS, is a very good positive thing. And to see, and if for Iran to help Iraq during this crisis, we can see that ISIS pose a big threat to both countries in terms of their ideologies and methods of going about their plans.
I mean, one thing we've always had from, if you like, the left wing of international politics and international law in particular, is the argument that we need exactly this kind of regional intervention. We need organizations like the Order of African States and the Arab Council to take more proactive efforts to prevent these kinds of mass conflict and insurgency. Do you think Iran's moves are in that general direction, or do you see this more as a one-off, do you think?
I tend to say more of a one-off. Again, I think in this case it is both the historical factors and relationship and the self-interest for Iran that's driving this in a more specific set of circumstances. Having said that, I'd certainly agree broadly with the view, not necessarily that in favor of plenty of regional interventions, but with the kind of liberal in terms of international relations liberalism in terms of greater institutions and greater dialogue and binding countries closer together in that respect to try and stop conflicts. However, on this case, I imagine saying what the realist would say in this sense, that it is totally and in this case I'd agree, in this case perhaps it is more self-interest at governing this specific action, but that doesn't mean that greater regional bodies, like on a wider level the Arab League or things like that, can't, maybe if they can be strengthened to try and help stop this kind of thing in the future.
I think it might be a great thing, as it won't have to constantly rely on the US for protection or interventions.
In Iraq, you mean?
In Iraq. And to say they will strengthen the region as a whole and possibly get back into more economic ventures to increase the prosperity of the region will be a better thing.
Yeah, to build on that, it is increasingly important for many of these countries to actually develop ways in which they're going to either prevent or deal with these conflicts without relying on the US, because clearly, predominantly on the back of Afghanistan and Iraq, the US probably wisely is well less willing to be a global policeman than they were then, and obviously in some cases are becoming maybe not isolationist, but certainly perhaps very sensibly less willing to go into any conflict to be the world's policeman, because as Iraq and Afghanistan have shown, what may look like simple interventions at first can certainly morph into much longer, more complicated interventions. And so clearly the US cannot be or should not be expected by every country to necessarily be intervene in there and be kind of the backup if they need some help. And in that case, certainly countries are going to need better ways and different ways to try and solve these problems on their own.
Well, that actually leads me on to another question which comes out of all of this, which is, you know, in the wake of, on the one hand, the Obama regime's seemingly greater pacifism, if you can call it that, or if you like, a second wave of Somalia syndrome, of just exactly that kind of fatigue with interventions where the benefit isn't particularly clear. Do you think we're going to see any sort of Western intervention? I mean, you have David Cameron in this country coming out and talking about the mounting threat of ISIS in Iraq. I believe he said at PMQs today that ISIS posed a greater threat to national security than jihadists returning from Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, you can quibble the facts of that, but that's exactly the kind of language that led us to war in 2003. Do you think we'll see that kind of incursion again?
Well, I think a couple of days ago, I think Dave Cameron at least ruled out any kind of military intervention certainly anywhere near the scale of Iraq, and certainly Obama's, I think, being far more measured than certainly Bush was in contemplating any intervention. I think in both cases they are very reluctant to intervene in any way. I don't think Britain will in any way get involved. Whether USA, with their greater ability for, say, removed strikes, whether or not they do airstrikes, I'm not sure they'll even do that. I think the most unless factors change to an extent which really forces their hand, I think the most they could possibly do is perhaps drone strikes, which they're doing in countries anyway without being at war in, which obviously you can get onto a whole question of legality and ethics of drones, but in terms of consistency, that would not be quite the same escalation and potential to lead to conflict perhaps as other intervention. But any kind of intervention will be limited, and I think because in many ways the Somali syndrome, and with the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan, they are very reluctant to get involved in any significant form again.
If they do get involved, it will put a great hamper to their political position in the coming elections, as in a lot of the public are pretty tired of constant war between 2001 to currently at this point, where wars in Iraq, people from both the United States and many other NATO countries sending soldiers to basically fruitless wars with no real end in sight. So it will be quite difficult to convince the public of any particular intervention at this point.
You don't think it's changed at all since the Commons voted down the possibility of intervention then?
I am actually not sure about it, since I've not read much about the situation, so...
Okay, fair enough. Well, next question then, I suppose, final question just to wrap this thing up, is if, as the panel seems to think, military intervention, perhaps beyond a few US airstrikes, isn't on the table, does that mean that we should do effectively what we've been doing for the past two and a half years with Syria and just throw up our hands and go, I don't know. Is there anything the West can be doing to intervene effectively in this situation? Should it?
I suppose the answer... First question is, in many ways, no. I think, short of anything more than just helping the, trying to help the Iraqi government, maybe given advice, maybe resource, I don't know to the extent whether they do need resource in the same extent it was discussed for, say, the Syrian rebels, but obviously the steps beyond that into significant intervention are, you know, more significant military intervention, which will lead potentially, you know, to another war. So I think in this case it is going to have to be a very limited role of the West in this, and unfortunately that, I think that's the necessary, well, not say evil, but I think any greater intervention will be unwise for the kind of issue reasons we've discussed already.
Intervention will have to be severely limited compared to previous interventions. Even in Syria, the US government was donating, well, sending in guns for the rebels to help against the prime minister at the time. But it seems it has not worked out, as in the country is almost in a 3-year civil war, in terms of a lot of people dying and a lot of infrastructure destroyed. So it would have to be a more tactical and thought out approach of doing these interventions before it gets out of hand.
Okay, thanks for that. I think we're going to move on at this point. Yes, we will move on then to our second debate of the evening, Scottish independence. Before I get into the spiel about this, remember you can, of course, text in 07762-212-434 or send a free web text, urn1350.net. Been saying that a lot recently. In any event, it is 26 minutes past 6. And I'll launch straight into it. We are now officially in the 100-day campaign lead-in to the Scottish referendum, which will be held on the 19th of September and will determine whether or not the country tries to become independent from the United Kingdom. With both the Yes and Better Together campaigns stepping up their publicity in a bid for the significant undecided component of the Scottish populace. While the no vote, keeping Scotland in the UK, has the largest share of the vote in lead-in polls, there is enough slack to swing it for the independents. And so we commentators can look forward to a long season of protracted political circus. It's already started amidst outlanded stunts, including large publicised bets on the result, and a number of celebrity voices have come out on both sides of the debate as well. Foreign politicians, actors and authors, including figures as diverse as Barack Obama, David Tennant and J.K. Rowling, have all added their voices to the debate. The Pope has additionally made some ambiguous comments that both campaigns claim support from, in deference to the 1 in 5 Scots who are Catholic. With less than 100 days left to the vote, independence remains a controversial topic as ever it was, with the SNP publishing its draft constitution and repeating claims to rid Scotland of the Trident nuclear deterrent and to keep the UK's current opt-outs of the EU requirements that it has. However, these claims have all come under fire, with the former Prime Minister John Major, for instance, saying that the chances of obtaining the opt-outs post-independence are nil, leaving plenty to play for as September comes around. So to kick this debate off, I actually want to take our minds back to the last time we spoke about this issue, 3-4 months ago. And the panel then were fairly certain of a no vote when the poll comes up in September. But since then, the Yes campaign has been making lots of strides in the polls, and the Better Together campaign has been suffering a bit from a look of increasing desperation. Do you think we are going to see a different result? Do you think that Scottish independence is a realistic prospect? Luke, what do you think?
It could be a possibility, but it is riddled with a lot of economic problems in terms of if Scotland becomes independent, it will have a different currency that is not related to the pound. And we don't know the actual conversion rate as it relates to other economies and their currencies. This can be seen as a similar problem as with when Bitcoin came out and we didn't know the value of Bitcoin compared to other currencies. Though Scotland has pretty good economic stance, as it contributes about 48% of the GDP in terms of its companies state that are stationed within Scotland. As one of the John Majors said, in terms of the goals being met being nil, it will take time for those goals to be actually met. Not everything happens on an instant. That's basically about it.
I think I'd say, in fact, it's more likely now actually that Scotland won't be independent, judging by the polls, than it was last time. Although I still think it's a definite possibility. It seems like the lead, which is actually certainly thinning, was still a lead from the campaign, I believe, last time we talked, but was distinctly thinning and looking like at this point it may have decreased worse. Now I believe I saw a poll today, which I believe was 53 for no and then 44 for yes, which is actually a bit of a healthier gap. And I think increased to 60 for the yes for the no campaign, and I can't remember exactly what, but and so and 40 then for the no for the yes campaign. So I when you disclude don't know, so there's still certainly a lead for the Better Together campaign, it would seem, at this stage. But obviously within the 100 days there is room for that to change, and so it's certainly by no means set in stone. As you said, David Ottsett, the political circus will certainly have some substance to a discuss during silly season, which will make a change, I suppose. But as for the second point, really, about the question about how Scotland would do as an independent country, certainly I think the debate so far has been dominated by the questions of the unknown questions, both as the over the EU, both as in whether we'd join the EU, whether we'd be obligated to join the EU, whether we want to join the EU, or whether we want to join the pound, with Scotland and the SNP insisting they'd be able to. But so far, well, it's only a Chancellor, and both the Shadow Chancellor and Daniel Alexander saying that they wouldn't be able to. And the SNP say that that would change clearly if they did vote for referendum. But certainly those questions are still to be told, still up in the air, it seems. I suppose we'll only know for certain the answer to those questions. Well, either way, if whichever option happens, we may never know, obviously, if there's a no vote, whether or not they would have been able to in a yes vote. But so those kind of major questions that are still unresolved and still in many ways determine the polls for the Scottish referendum.
In terms of that, I think Alex Salmond has said that he envisions any potential independence, rather, happening not, of course, in September 2014, but in March 2016, allowing a substantial period of decoupling, both in terms of writing new legislation and legislating our way out of the UK, Scotland's way out of the UK, our way as well, I suppose. It's a one United Kingdom. But also in terms of hammering out these details. So this is, I suppose, directed to Luke. Is it really fair to automatically dismiss the possibility of a currency union, to dismiss the possibility of retaining those EU opt-outs? To what extent, I suppose, I'm asking, is that hyperbole?
I don't think it's hyperbole. I guess it has to come down to agreement with the EU or the UK, how they want to trade, what seems best for both parties to get a win-win agreement out of this. Though I would like to touch on various famous people, such as this Lee King from the China wants Scotland to stay as one United Kingdom, to be a stronger country in terms of economic power and way to lead other economic growth around other countries. But it depends on the people who live in Scotland. Do they want independence? Do they want their own freedom to do with their country?
Well, certainly, international support, said, both in China, but also President Obama has made several statements in support of Scotland staying in the United Kingdom. But obviously, as you said, that's not necessarily what's going to determine it. I think clearly, as to the point as to was it wise to the gap between voting for independence and the time to actually becoming independent is, of course, wise and a necessity to actually have a fully functioning state if they do vote for independence. And that does give a possibility, certainly, of negotiating the questions of the EU, of the currency, and various parts about shares of the national debt and missiles and where they'd be placed, and all those kind of maybe in the former points, the big questions, maybe the other one also the kind of slightly finer print. But having said that, the time certainly increases the chance of negotiating that, but doesn't necessarily mean they will be able to. Very much depends, obviously, in these cases with two sides, you can't determine everything. It depends on what the other side is willing to give. It remains to be seen to an extent whether or not I think any British government would be very reluctant to form in a currency union without an awful lot of financial controls over Scotland, in which case the financial independence would be severely limited of Scotland. As for the EU, I get the sense of it probably, one of the major questions there is whether Spain would block it because they don't want to encourage Catalonia to seek independence in the future. However, I feel as the EU as a whole, given the current situation, they'd probably be thrilled to have as many people as possible, as or people joining the EU to show it or give it the appearance of a greater strength. So I think, depending what Spain do, I think they're more likely to find a way to get into the EU. I'd still be very sceptical of them being able to enjoy all the opt-outs they currently have, given I think much of Europe sees those as a obtuse UK and Eurosceptic Britain trying to get those. So whether they'd let Scotland keep those, I don't know, and I'm even more sceptical as to whether any UK Chancellor would allow Scotland to use the pound without severe restrictions, in which case, unless they're certain joining the EU and then the euro, which I imagine would be unpopular, I think there are the question of currency is perhaps the biggest one, perhaps outside of identity and that kind of sense, that really has to be addressed by the campaign.
We can perhaps turn to these the celebrity endorsements that I mentioned in the report and that Luke, you brought up a little bit earlier. I mean, do you think they're going to have any real effect on the Scottish people? It's been going on for quite a while now, in all fairness, to make it sound like a new phenomenon, but it was kick-started the last time we talked about this 3-4 months ago when David Bowie waved in on Scottish independence, urging the Scottish people to stay in the union. And since then, as you've said and as I've said, there's been quite a lot of comment coming in on both sides. Do you think that's going to have any sort of impact?
I honestly hope it doesn't have any impact in terms of swaying the vote either way. It should be up to the Scottish people to make their choices on whether they want independence or not. But I do despise the fact that some celebrities did donate money in terms of trying to lobby against Scottish independence, which I feel is a very despicable position to do.
I think it's probably a limited impact of celebrities, although it's quite funny seeing various tweets about J.K. Rowling on Twitter immediately after she wrote independence, with various people getting very angry about that. But apart from that, I don't think a real substance. Maybe there'll be some people, I don't know, if avid Scottish Harry Potter fans who is not normally engaged will say, okay, I'll vote for the Better Together campaign because of this. I feel in reality it's going to have a very limited impact. And in reality, I think it will be the both the solid questions, as you said, with the currency and things like that, and also the issues of identity, and also the questions of direction and the ideology and what they want Scotland to be, and whether or not that fits with the union or not. So I think, although they make for nice headlines and occasional kind of maybe brief interesting moments, I think really the celebrity endorsements will have a very limited impact in reality.
I just want to ask one question in terms of, do you think that if J.K. Rowling had not donated a large sum of money in terms of £100 million towards the No campaign, would she have gotten the same vitriol as if she had not donated but still voiced the same opinion?
So it's her fault that she's gotten all of this Twitter backlash, you're saying?
Well, she made a comment, but in terms of like, If she still had made a comment, but there was no financial backing, would the vitriol been the same?
I think it would have been quite similar, actually. I think it's mainly the coming out and supporting it in general, and I think these people tweeting everything are the most ardent of the Yes campaign, and can't be seen necessarily as representative of the campaign as a whole, but see this as a betrayal of it, and certainly many in the Yes campaign, Scotland, do see it as kind of staying in the union, as saying those, particularly those nasty Tories in Westminster, saying there's a connection to do, may not be the campaign as a whole, and so therefore see this as a traitor to helping the Tories against Scotland becoming a more social democratic, further left state. So I think that's the major issue, and certainly the extreme cases we've seen on Twitter, I think clearly no one deserves that kind of vitriol for expressing their opinion or donating money. Although having said that, why no one deserves it, I think given the state of Twitter and the internet and various things, I think while no one deserves it, I think everyone comes to expect it in a certain respect, given the nature of some of the people who post on Twitter and YouTube and how little else they seem to do with their time.
Well, which I think we can all agree is not particularly a very good thing. We've had a text in from Claire B, who's asked me not to read it out, but it does lead on quite nicely to the last question I wanted to ask, so I'll paraphrase it. She mentions that a lot of the people who are voting for yes, in her opinion, aren't doing it for the sort of, if you like, grounded, objective, economics-based arguments, and I put all of those arguments in scare quotes, but are more concerned with the symbolism of it, of breaking away from a United Kingdom that doesn't represent them, as Seb said, the nasty Tories in Westminster, although, you know, not necessarily quite as patronising as I just made that sound. The point still stands. We see that coming through a lot, I think, in the new Scottish constitution that the SNP are proposing, in their moves to put greater emphasis on human rights at the centre of a constitutional system, in their moves to get away from the Westminster system of politics. And the question that's raised then is, even if there's a no vote in September 2014, which we're all still seemingly of the opinion is probably going to be the case, however narrow the margin, what comes after? Is this the end of any change in the Scottish system? Because we've seen all three of the Scottish variants of the main Westminster parties coming out and offering their bids for non-independence, and all of them involve some measure of increased devolution of faculties. Is there anything to stop us from, say, ending up in a federated states of the UK? Seb?
Quite meaty level of question, which is always good. If just kind of the first point, I think the there are kind of two points in the... I think there is the romanticized ideals of independence, slightly Braveheart, which are less substantive, which maybe, as Claire says, people are voting to it. But I think at the same time, the second point about the identity and kind of nasty Tories versus social democracy is more substantive key question, which is obviously the SNP have tried to distance themselves place themselves firmly in opposition to at the moment, you know, nasty Tories in government, while Scottish Labour in fact argued in their last conference that the SNP were like the Tories in the north. And it was Labour who would be the far more social democratic further left party. So, to an extent, it seems to be about how anti-Tory they are. And we know Scotland, as a whole, are less Tory and more anti-Tory than the rest of the UK. Hence why, at the moment, it's projected that the Conservatives would do far better if Scotland did become independent. So, certainly, those are kind of... I have more sympathy for the second, more substantive... bit about Scottish identity and how that new Scottish state's ideology would fit with people in Scotland at the moment than perhaps the less important views of kind of romanticised views of independence, although not necessarily confusing that with again the core idea of Scottish identity and where that fits with the union. So can I ask, what was the kind of second part of that question again?
The actual question was, what do you think we're moving towards a more federated UK? Do you think that there are going to be more of the, if there is a no vote, or even if there's a yes vote, do you think we're going to see greater federation, greater devolution? What do you see as the end point of all of this?
I certainly do see further devolution. As you said, all three major parties in Scotland have committed further devolution. I know... since the Liberal Democrats have said today about, you know, further devolution and agreeing to, I believe it's the Silk recommendations for devolution. So, as I said, I do see a no vote as more likely at this stage, but I think whatever no votes, there will be further devolution for Scotland, and hopefully to a stage where if Scotland does want to remain part of the EU, which at least get to a level of devolution and federalism, which, while keeping the union together, does allow the Scottish people to create a Scottish... well, not state, but a space in Scotland that is sufficiently like their ideology, even if the rest of the UK and Westminster isn't.
Uh-huh. Luke?
I'd like to touch on the first point where she states, on our thinking about the economic impact of the independence. I would say it's pretty difficult to have an accurate view on how independence would affect economically Scotland, because it is very difficult to get big to data to accurately map how your economy will do at a certain amount of time. It's a very fast changing kind of system, and even some models will fail easily. So, but in terms of getting people to listen and read and research about the economic possibilities and what is possible and what is not possible and what are the difficulties of independence. It is kind of boring for a lot of people, and there are very few who would actually go out of their way to go and search about it. A lot of politics is mainly charisma, and that's how you get in, not about people who actually fact-check your lot of sources.
Okay, I hate to hurry you along, but do you have any opinion about whether we're heading towards federation or devolution or any of that?
It's possibly a federation, but I hope there'll be a cooperative federation between the UK and Scotland in terms of promoting trade between each other and through Europe.
We're going to move on now to our last debate. We're going to talk for the last 10 minutes or so about The Sun and its recent controversial free issue, and how that was picked up in particular by Ed Miliband. And before I get into the substance of that, let's just remind you again, you can all follow in Claire's example and have your words picked apart for, by us live on air, because why wouldn't you want that? 07762212434 is the number to use by conventional text, or you can send us a free web text, urn1350.net. Okay, so the start of the World Cup always brings out a spate of cash-ins on the patriotic zeal that seems to accompany English football. And this year has been no different. And amidst the usual plastic flags and paper-thin excuses to daub any product under the sun in white and red, a controversy has erupted around the Sun newspaper's decision to distribute millions of free copies across England, ostensibly to celebrate the tournament. The Twitterati's response was perhaps expectable, with anti-Sun social media pundits soon flooding the internet with suggestions for a free post address to return the Sun to, creative ways to dispose of the paper, and signs telling the postie in not too uncertain terms not to slide a copy through their letterboxes. Meanwhile, Westminster has seen its share of controversy by association. All three major party leaders had photographs taken with their free issues, raising particular problems for Ed Miliband's Labour supporters. Between those infuriated by the Blair regime's close ties with the Murdoch Empire and the phone hacking scandal, as well as the emergent note-a-page free campaign, the ostensibly centre-left Labour politician would have been in hot water enough, without, of course, the historical flack that came his way from Liverpudlian Labour voters. The city, of course, continues to boycott the paper en masse for its blame in the Hillsborough disaster on Liverpool football fans, rather than negligent police work. So whilst Miliband has apologised, it remains to be seen how much this affects his party's dynamic with his voters, and indeed with the Murdoch press. So, in lieu of the time, we might skip forward straight to Ed Miliband and, you know, ask, should he have posed with the paper, given his party and particularly Liverpudlian Labour supporters' ire against this? Was this just a spectacular PR flop, or is this something he was legitimately entitled to do?
I think in the end it is probably more a PR flop than anything. I think it's been well documented to an extent how powerful, or perhaps how supposedly powerful, the Sun is in determining elections. I think me and many others are sceptical quite whether it's as powerful as both people and certainly it says it is, but I don't think anyone thinks it's as quite as influential as the Sun does. But certainly there is a view that, you know, if you can appeal to, and, you know, the Sun voters, you know, obviously New Labour famously are backing the winning of It Was the Sun That Done It, likewise, and although it giving a Cameron its endorsement in 2010 was certainly enough to have them the largest party, I think certainly it's focused on pursuing the voters of the Sun, and thinking that if there seem to be the Sun, then that similar to Sun pursue those voters, then maybe they'll get them. However, on the other hand, I said all three party leaders posed with it, which would seem really to nullify any benefit to all of them, and of course all of them will take it in Liverpool, which is clearly going to be the biggest problem for Ed Miliband, because that's where the strongest Liverpool have. On the flip side, if both Nick Clegg and David Cameron did also posed with it, then maybe there won't be an impact in that response, or that if I presume Nigel Farage then didn't, maybe UKIP will get some boost. But I think it's in many ways a fool's game just to hold up a copy of the Sun and then expect to try and win those voters. Perhaps it's particularly because it's the This Is Britain one, they won't seem patriotic, but certainly I'd say it's more of a PR flop than a well calculated PR move.
Okay, Luke?
I would say he does have the right to pose with a photo and have his photo be published, though he should have been aware of the PR repercussions with Liverpool and Middlesbrough in terms of how they would react considering past events that has happened to him. Though I would don't have much to say about this, but the weirdest part about it is the nature of the photo. It is the most disturbing smile I've seen for a long while. And I hope he trying to get rid of that photo will be terribly difficult.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? We've already started to see it turn up on BuzzFeed photo lists and things like that. We've seen quite a lot of them recently. Alex Salmond with his leg up playing football and all of that. It always comes back to football with this. I can't stand football. Anyway, point of all of this, I suppose, is to ask, given that we've seen all three of the main party leaders, as we've said, holding up this picture, that seems to put fire on the Sun's own claims of still being able to be a political kingmaker. Do you think Rupert Murdoch still occupies that position post phone hacking? Do you think the Sun is as powerful as it once perhaps was? And you know, to what extent will it be inevitable that the politicians continue to court it as one of the largest newspapers currently in circulation?
I think it's less popular and less of a kingmaker than it was, but I think it still remains the most influential of those parties because it has such great circulation and because it is associated anyway with parties moving somewhat to the centre, about centre right in terms of modernising parties, seeking it and seeking to an extent the centre ground, although it could be argued that both David Cameron in 2010 and Tony Blair in 97 were in many respects centre right rather than centre, but increasingly I think any individual paper's influence certainly between the three parties is going to diminish as long as much of the public's support and enthusiasm for Westminster politics and the three main parties in particular remains so low.
I believe the whole entire situation, it was blown out of proportion, as both three parties have been posted pictures of the Sun. And they have conflicting ideologies, but to focus on Ed Miliband so viciously is pretty problematic. Though it is a great marketing tool by the Sun to have their papers just distributed freely without any cost.
Well, we might talk about that, I suppose. Is this something that the Sun, I guess, needed to do? We've heard for decades that newspapers are dying off, that they're being replaced by television and radio and all of this, and they're doggedly hanging on despite having to compete with free news over the internet. And the Sun still holds a considerable amount of market share. Do you think this is something that other newspapers will be encouraged to replicate? Seb?
I don't think so. I think in many respects this particular issue was focused on the World Cup buzz and everyone and everything trying to latch on to that and that enthusiasm. It's often said that the World Cup's the only time you can parade in the English flag without looking like a racist. And so clearly any politician, I said any paper, anything that can be associated with the England football team, certainly the first stage of the World Cup, is going to supposedly, if it gets significant enough attachment, see a benefit. Obviously, that will change when we lose on penalties and everyone hates the England football team again.
I think they might see it as a possible method in upcoming national events such as Olympics or possibly another World Cup. But in terms of whether it's dying or not, there's a lot of ways to get your news now in terms of having an RSS feed on your phone, going on the internet, getting straight to your mobile phone. It's a lot easier compared to a newspaper, which is physical and you have to be carried around. Although, it will take quite a while for the newspaper to actually die in terms of how fast it has to catch up to how technology advance in the near future.
Okay, I think we will end on that note then. This has been The Big Picture for the last time until September 2014. They'll be back next year, as I've said, I won't be. And I just want to take the last 2 minutes here to indulge myself in a completely self-indulgent exercise of self-satisfaction and just say what a pleasure it's been, really. I mean, this show has been going on for so, so long now. There are so many people who've made it what it is today, right from the start of my involvement. People like Will Cooling, Matt Gale, Simon Alvey, Thomas Priest, right the way through Simon Brown, Rob Lowcock, David Horseman, more recent people like Charlie Bentley, Matt Bradshaw Hughes, Johnny Jenkins, Joe Todd, through to the people who are still involved to this day, many of whom unfortunately haven't been able to take to the airwaves to say goodbye to you. I suppose I'd say, you know, I think we do have quite a low listenership on this show. I think we're perhaps not the most attractive to a student audience, but if we've ever changed anyone's opinion about anything, if we've ever illuminated a political debate that people didn't know about before or that they didn't know very much about before, if we've ever interested anyone in politics, if we've even just passed an idle hour for something, I think the last 7 years on the whole have been more or less worth it. Speaking of Johnny Jenkins, this is for you. And he'll know what that is. In any event, I'd just like to finish off by passing you to my favourite band of all time, the now sadly deceased REM. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. This has been The Big Picture. It has been my privilege and my pleasure to take you through the evening. And we will leave you with this.